Welcome to ITE 1, Module 1, Part 3. Before I start, does anyone have any questions on the labs, or on any of the curriculum, or exams, or anything like that?
Slightly off topic,
since I've already finished the exam, is there going to be anything new?
You got spoken over, Tom.
I just said, since I've already done the exam, is there going to be anything new?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, Grace's sparkling take on all of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And then Sean doing his Module 2
stuff.
Yeah,
you're going to miss my chapter. So
I won't go in.
You can sleep through, but you could probably go and do something else for half an hour if you wanted to.
I'll have a nap here. Yell my name when it's time for me to wake up.
Okay, we'll do that. All right. Anything else? What did you need, Luke?
I was going to say, do you want a copy of that glossary abbreviations thing that I've been working on? I'm currently halfway through chapter 5.
Okay, absolutely. That would be great.
Is there a glossary in ITE1 that's accessible? There is one in...
No, it's inaccessible.
There
garbage.
Might be in the curriculum, but yeah, it's probably not going to be
we can't use
we
it.
Can use.
And welcome, Edward. Hello. Okay. So, anyone else?
Now, we all know that by this week, and you should be all have been seeing the task mailouts, that we should have completed 1.4.7 and 1.2, I think is the...
1.1.2
are the two labs, and you should have possibly already sat your Module 1 exam or be gearing up to do it this week. Or
that is this week. You can do it this week, and you'll have another lab to work on. Also, if you feel like you were brave, you can start your assembly-disassembly, either by working on from the recordings or doing your own.
Now, somebody was asking questions. Actually, yes, it was Pat, I remember now. She was asking what things looked like last week, I think, if my memory serves. And up in the ITE1 area are some absolutely ripper hardware descriptions. So as well as Ian getting his fingers mashed between hard disk magnets when I specifically told him not to put his fingers in the way, we also go through all of the different portions of the computer and the system board and the case and the drives and everything, and we actually tear apart CD-ROM drives and explain what's in the middle of them. So I'd strongly recommend...
Yeah, and floppy drives too.
Oh yeah, cool. We pulled the floppy drive apart, yeah. So we actually go, there are three different parts, they're about 15 minutes long each, and it's basically Geraldine, Kerry, Sue, Ian, Gemma, and co, back in 2007, tear bits of hardware apart. And Geraldine and I fight about how big things are, so Geraldine's like, oh, it's an inch big, and I'm like, 3/4 of an inch. So we sort of have a bit of tete-a-tete on that, so I'd strongly recommend that to people, especially with the assembly-disassembly labs coming up.
It was good.
It's a lot of fun. We think it is, anyway. And then there are actually assembly-disassembly labs in the same area that let you listen to people pull apart computers and put them back together. And it's the next best thing to doing it yourself. It's about as close as we can get.
And totally slam their elbows on desks.
I had Aiden calling me up. He's like, oh my gosh, are you okay after that lab? And I'm like, what? And he's like, you've slammed your elbow on the desk. And I'm like, did I? I don't remember doing that. So, yes, you can hear me apparently slam my arm down on the table really hard. All right.
How far does assembly go?
How far does assembly go?
We tear everything out of the case and everything back in.
You go down to the motherboard. We don't do motherboard. That assembly disassembly goes from the motherboard up.
No, we don't. No, you don't. You didn't take the processor off when you did it.
No, we don't take.
No, we only go down to the motherboard. No. We take all the cards out and we take all the drives out. We do not and the cables off. We do not remove the processor and heatsink because these machines are 5 years old, and there's sort of like this tacky.
I think the text actually discusses.
The text actually does discuss doing that.
Discusses how
you
would do it. That's right.
And what about the power supply?
Yes, the power supply comes out.
Yeah, the only part that a blind person might legitimately have a real problem with is heating the processor in a heat sink, and that mostly just because touching it the wrong way can break it. Other than that, it's, for the most part, pretty easy to do, even then.
Although,
case wiring is almost impossible, I've done it too, so don't pull that out.
I'm always afraid, so...
Well, usually the fear decreases with experience until you start breaking them, and then the fear builds back up again. So
pretty much,
a self-regulating system.
I currently have a greater break to success ratio, so I'm still nervous about it.
Fair enough.
The processor is about the only thing I haven't pulled out of any computers. I've put hard drives and RAM and the rest of that. So, speaking from
I have
from
done
that
it. I've never done it unsupervised, but.
Yeah, I've never done the processor.
What about the actual memory?
Yep, you pop the memory out. The memory is... But if you have trouble with the memory, don't feel bad. It took me 90 minutes to stick my first piece of RAM into a computer. And just because I'm
probably
just
took
not
about
very 30 coordinated.
Seconds for the second one.
No, it got good. It took me a while to get down to 30 seconds.
I wish it took me that long. Maybe my computer wouldn't have gone smoke.
Yeah, fair enough.
I'm just wondering, is it possible you forgot to pull the power cord out of the back of your machine when you pulled the RAM out, Aiden? Because I'm thinking that's what might have nuked it. Because if it still had standby power on it, that's probably what crispied your sticks of memory.
That's possible. Yeah, I thought I pulled it out, but I didn't really pull it out of the machine because it's hard to get back there. So I just kind of... I jerked it so that it out of the socket, but or out of the pins, but not completely out of the socket, because I didn't want to be reaching down the desk and straining various muscles to put them back in.
You bad person!
Ah, so the truth comes out. That's what happened. And I kept saying to you, I don't know why this happened to you. I don't know why this happened to you. Well, now I do.
Yeah, whoops.
Fair enough.
Hey, you'll know how to do it differently next time.
You guys? Always unplug. Always unplug that computer.
Yeah.
Also, a pro tip when doing
power
computer
switch if you've got one.
Messing with the internals of computers, if you yank on something so hard that the socket comes unseated, that's a good hint that you've done something wrong.
Yeah, no, and I never did that, but yeah.
Just a pro tip from me to you. You're welcome.
Oops. I think Drew's done that before. Okay, let's go on to raid, guys, because we've got a lot to cover. So, this isn't your test. All these raids are in your test, and you'll want to know a little bit about the differences between them. So, raid, does anyone remember what raid stands for? This one.
Gary almost gave it away earlier.
I actually...
How's this?
That's good. That's what you want.
Yeah.
She sort of has far too much treble on this horrible Skype microphone, so I'll be smashing that evening.
Fine.
Oh my god, it's Grace!
Sennheiser back in.
I don't know.
That was the scariest Grace I've ever... No, I'm just kidding.
Okay. So, Now, did anyone know about what RAID stood for? I'm sorry, because Carrie just
Someone said it, yeah.
Okay, cool. Good for you. Awesome.
So if you didn't hear, it was redundant array of inexpensive disk drives, disks, a word that starts with D that sounds like disks.
Yep. Okay, you will do this...
I thought it was independent.
No.
Redundant array of inexpensive disks.
It's either, actually. Disks. It's both. It's independent or inexpensive. Yeah. It was inexpensive until people sort of had a squawk and went, but it's not inexpensive, so they changed it to independent. It just depends on which drive literature you're reading as to which one it is. I would go for inexpensive.
Inexpensive is the Cisco.
Oh, Carrie, and by the way, now I am noticing the microphone, so thanks very much for pointing it out, because I probably wouldn't
I might just swap headsets with her, I think, because, gee, she sounds awful. Here, I'll give her my Sennheisers.
Okay, hold on.
I sense a lot of editing coming for the recording.
Yeah.
He didn't realize he was keying up.
I'll take this moment to relay a stupid thing I did once. When I was installing cards, I didn't actually unseat a socket, but what I have done is I somehow managed to get a PCI card inserted into two different sockets.
Oh, good job!
Oh, good job!
It didn't work. I'll just spoiler warning, it broke.
Yeah, I bet.
That FireWire card is no longer usable by anyone.
Okay, I guess I'm not audible.
It smoked.
You're here.
I'm much better. Stop.
You're good, Bryce.
Thank you.
Something broke. It made a bad smell, and now it no longer.
No,
works.
You don't. You sound just fine.
Nah, there's lots of treble in it. Trust me. I'll show you later.
One of the things we're gonna. By the way, this didn't get mentioned earlier, but one of the things we're gonna really start asking people to do. He's pleased to wear headphones, just because it makes our lives
absolutely fantastic.
So much easier.
Otherwise, you loop audio back onto lecture. And like yesterday, we actually had somebody reading their Twitter on speakers, and that wasn't very cool, and we told them so. So please, if you're going to check whether the Packers won the game, can you please do it in your headphones, because we don't need to know on lecture.
Yes, that would be fantastic.
It's a bit embarrassing, yeah.
All right, so...
Two people have done.
All right. So these are... RAID is used for increased reliability and speed of accessing data. The operating system is going to see your RAID as one logical disk. Here are some terms you need to know to understand RAID. Parity is a method used to detect data errors. Striping is a method used to write data across multiple drives. And we've got mirroring, which is a method of storing duplicate data to a separate drive.
Okay, I have a bad joke very quickly. Why did Long John Silver's bird keep saying pieces of seven, pieces of seven? Because it had a parity error. Okay, continue.
Oh, goodness. Okay, there's a really good table describing the different types of RAID, which you should definitely study. But here's a quick, dirty introduction of the most commonly used types of RAID, because you'll be tested on the difference between them, mainly 0 and 1. So RAID 0 is striping, no mirroring, and this is used to access data quickly. So you're not going to have any backups here, no error correction. You're just going to have data on different drives, little bits of data on different drives to access data quicker.
It's also worth mentioning that with a RAID 0 array, you actually double the probability of losing your data, because if either drive fails, you lose half your data, and that half is usually striped across the entire set. So you actually become more likely to have a failure with RAID 0, because you've got two drives that could fail.
RAID 1 is mirroring, no striping. So you're going to just basically have, for every drive that you have with data on it, you're going to have another drive. So it's two drives for every one that you're actually using. All right, RAID 4 is striping with one parity drive. So writing to the array is slow because it has to check it with the parity drive. And RAID 5 is striping with all drives used for parity. So it's going to be much faster than RAID 4. All right. That is RAID. And that's about as much as you need to know for RAID on this test. If you want to know more about RAID, talk to Carrie later, because we actually run a RAID array and all of that good stuff. All right. It's time
to
move on.
I've always found RAID a bit tricky.
Yeah.
And I've done this a few times, but I still find it tricky.
Okay, now we're going to review internal cables. The buttons and the LED lights on the front of the case connect to the motherboard with the front panel cables. These are really thin cables, and they need to be installed on headers on the motherboard. You need to read the manual and match the different tiny wires to the different tiny headers on the board. Usually these are color-coded or something of that sort. This is usually a job for a friendly neighborhood sighted person, unless you are really lonely, and then you can sit there and do trial and error, I guess, if you must.
You can actually manage it. The only one you absolutely have to connect is the power. So if the chips are down, you can actually get a multimeter and look for plus 5 volts on the power and find the two pins that, when you short them to ground, will actually turn the machine on, and then plug the power button into that. So if you have no other way and the computer has to run, that's the only one you have to hook up. Has anybody seen the way Asus do it now, with the little connector that you actually plug onto the end of all the little wires and then plug into the system board? That's really cool.
That is really awesome.
I'm sorry, Carrie, who does that now?
Asus. Okay, so your drives need both a power and a data cable to run. So for internal drives, we're going to need two cables. The power cable comes from the power supply, and the data cable comes from the controller on the motherboard, or the adapter card. A floppy uses 34-pin ribbon cable that has connectors for up to two floppy drives. Drive A goes on the end nearest the twist in the ribbon cable, followed by an optional drive B, and the other end goes to the floppy controller. So you're going to have a question on at least one of your tests about how you can tell which end of a floppy drive goes into the drive and which end goes into the controller. And remember that the answer is that the floppy drive actually has a twist in it to tell you that that end goes into the drive A. All right. Can anyone tell me what's used to power a floppy drive?
Burr connector.
That's absolutely right. Good job. That's a 4-pin connector, guys, and it is very it's small and rectangular. It's smaller than your EID cable.
What? Don't you mean smaller than your Molex?
Smaller than your Molex connector. I'm looking at the wrong word on my screen.
Oops.
Yeah, yeah. Because the next thing I wanted to talk to you about...
better be smaller than a 9-connect.
Yeah, I know. It's smaller than your Molex. An EIDE cable has two connectors for drives and one to plug into the controller. The original IDE cable had 40 pins and 40 wires. The modern ones have 80 wires, 40 for data transfer, and 40 for grounding. That's a question on your test. So it's going to ask you how many wires the PODA cable has, or IDE cable has, and the answers are 40 and 80, because there are two checkboxes there that you'll have to check. Okay.
I love I so much.
I don't.
As you will hear through the coming lecture, I really, really just love everything about I
what
so
we've heard
much.
Before.
Oh, you love it as much as I do then. All right.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, this allows the 80-pin or the 80-wire cable allows the EIDE standard to transfer at fast speeds. Something you need to be aware of, even though your new PODA connectors have 80 wires, they still only have 40 pins, so it's still a 40-pin connector on the motherboard.
How fast does IDE go, actually?
So each pin
like,
has
what's
two
the theoretical
wires?
Limit?
133 megabytes per second is the top speed of IDE.
Okay.
And most
oh, right, PODA 133. Right.
Yeah, but they can't actually sustain. You won't find too many drives these days that'll sustain 133 megabytes per second from plane
right,
to
let alone
computer.
6 gigs a second like
yeah,
a SATA does, but
absolutely.
That's jumping.
Well, it's not those wires don't connect to anything. They're grounding wires. They're to make sure that the electricity and power and data goes through well.
One of the weaknesses in the IDE specification was that because there were so many wires running in parallel in such close proximity, the cable was subject to interference, which could actually introduce data transfer errors between the controller and the drive. Fun times.
Absolutely. All right. So, who knows what cable power...
Down if it had.
Yeah. So, who knows what cable powers PODA drives? Say that.
It's a Molex.
Go ahead. It's a Molex. Yes, that's right. And good job, Vanessa and Luke. All right. That's a 4-pin connector, and it is a rectangle, and sometimes they can be really hard to get out.
They're fun.
Yeah. You do sometimes have to really pull on a Molex connector to get it out, and it's harder than you'd think you'd have to pull.
And if you pull on the wires, so we're gonna take your ITE1 license off you. Okay? Do not pull on the wires. Pull on the plug.
You grab that rectangular part and you pull the rectangular actual housing and it can take all of your strength to do that.
Yeah, generally we don't we don't pull plugs via the cord anyway, but I know everyone does it.
Yeah.
That goes for pretty much everything.
But they really shouldn't.
Yeah. Okay, guys. A SATA data cable has 7 pins. Yes, it has 7 pins. 7. 7. It's in a lot of tests, but not in your final anymore. 7 pins. Very important. Because for some reason, Cisco is obsessed with the fact that SATA has 7 pins. Don't ask me why. The SATA power cable has 15 pins, and the connector itself bends at a right angle. This is also something you need to remember because it's in a test later. So, the cable has 15 pins, bends down at a right angle, and,
what? Since when?
No,
SATA power connectors are flat.
What?
Yeah, it's flat, but it bends
it
down
doesn't.
Like a cord. Yeah, it does.
It doesn't.
Does.
No, they don't.
Some of the data cables have a 90-degree turn, but I've never seen power
some of the data cables do. Some of the power cables do, too, actually.
I've
like
seen the power
the
cable
end,
with a 90-degree turn. There's a little... Yeah. It goes in flat, and the cable comes down off it.
Yeah.
No,
oh,
it's
mine
not,
pulls out.
It's not a 90-degree bend. No, it doesn't. It's a straight plug-in on that. I can open this desktop and show you. It's a straight plug-in. You pull them straight in, straight out. So I don't know whether it's 90.
You do pull them in straight out, but it's this bend that is in the actual.
No, the cables come straight out from the plug, and then they just fall down with gravity. They do not turn at a 90-degree angle at all. I don't know where that came from. So.
The SCSI connectors? What is SCSI connectors?
Maybe it just depends on the.
Have we gotten those mixed
specific
cable.
Power
no,
supply
we haven't.
You get or whatever.
None of the ones in your machine bend at a 90-degree angle, Grace. No, they don't. I'll pull the side off and show you. None of them bend. They're all straight into the connector like they're 15 wires, but they're just straight
they're
in like 15. A Molex. They do not bend.
The one I have has where like the cable terminates into the connector that then turns to the right and plugs straight into the thing.
Yes, that's what I mean. It's that right bend. Yeah, it's that. That's what I'm talking
about. Where you plug it in is not parallel to where the cables come out.
Right.
Is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying.
It could depend on the cable you get, though, because I've had, like, the same cable has various connectors on the length of the cable, so.
Yeah, the ones I've seen do have that, it isn't parallel. So you've got the, where it plugs in, and then it,
Are we talking the data cable or the power cable here?
No, we're talking the power cable.
The power cable.
No. No, I've never seen ones
talking
with a bend.
Because I've seen them where the, you know there's four, let's say four connectors on a wire, a set of wires, and the connectors are 90 degrees facing away from where the cable runs, but
yeah,
it doesn't turn. That's just how it's mounted.
Right.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, because you have to mount them. You have to put them at 90 degrees to the cable run. Otherwise, you can't wire them on in parallel. But the actual connectors don't have any bends in them.
You'll see that in the test that says it has a 90-degree turn in it.
No,
actually, the only one that I've ever seen with a microchip.
It does say that.
There's only one that I've ever seen.
Uh huh.
Well, then I'm reporting I've a router to Cisco when we're done with the lecture.
A hard disk enclosure, which has actually got a 90-degree connector, but generally on your SATA cables, it's just a straightforward cable.
Okay, because I've seen it with 90-degree bend.
Well, we don't own any.
And again, with the data cables as well, some of them have turns on them and some of them don't.
Oh, okay, yeah, I've seen the straight data cables.
Yeah, I've seen both.
Alright, so we've got the eSATA cable that also has 7 pins. Now, it's important to know that eSATA never provides power, so you're always going to have an extra power pack for your eSATA drives. Alright, we've got SCSI data cables, which are not on your test anymore, I don't believe. A narrow SCSI data cable has 50 conductors, up to 7 50-pin connectors for drives, and 1 50-pin connector for the drive controller, also called the host adapter. You've got a wide SCSI cable. It has 68 conductors and up to 15 68-pin connectors for drives and one 68-pin connector for the host adapter. And we've got the Alt-4 SCSI data cable, which has 80 conductors, up to 15 80-pin connectors for drives, and one for the controller. A colored stripe on a cable is pin 1. Pin 1 must be lined up with pin 1 on the drive or controller. For us blind people, most of the cables that we now have are keyed, which helps us with this lining up a great deal, because it should only go in one way unless we really, really press it. Any questions on internal cables? All right, we're going to quickly go through external cables. A serial port can either be a DB9 or DB25 male connector. Serial ports transmit one bit of data at a time, so imagine the little line of data, just one straight line going one after another.
The ants are marching one by one, hurrah.
They do. To connect a serial device, such as a modem or a printer, a serial cable must be used. The cable has a maximum length of 50 feet or 15.2 meters. And we've got a parallel port. A parallel port on a computer is a standard type DB25 female connector. The parallel connector on a printer is a standard type B 36-pin Centronics connector, which means it's flat and it has no pins or holes. It's just a flat thing that is used by contact.
It's kind of a bar with little bumps on it,
yeah.
And it's got spring clips,
yeah, those
on
weird.
The ends that the printer has. Yeah, they are a bit weird. The printer has little spring clips that clip in these areas on the side.
I've never quite seen anything like it before.
Yeah, they're very strange.
Kind of cool.
I hate to go.
At least not.
No, I don't know what the deal is. Some newer printers.
Also, just to be extra confusing, there's some serial ports that have DIN connectors as well.
Really?
Yeah, there
those
are.
Pretty uncommon, though.
Your Braille light and your.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I guess that is a serial DIN connector.
Yeah, the newer Braille light models and the old Apple image writers, if anyone remembers those things.
Nah, they
Double Talks have them. There's a version of the Double Talk that's got a 5-pin DIN and a 9-pin connector. So you can get DIN serial ports.
All right. Some newer printers may use a Type-C high-density 36-pin connector. Honestly, most new printers use USB. But you know what? Who's counting?
This is sponsored by HP, and a lot of their gear does use parallel. Settle.
Okay.
I've seriously never heard of that 36 connector.
Apparently.
I think I've seen it once.
Yeah, I don't know. Parallel ports can transmit 8 bits of data at one time and use the IEEE 1284 standard. So the ants go marching 8x8. Hurrah, hurrah for parallel. To connect a parallel device such as a printer, a parallel cable must be used. Yeah. A parallel cable has a maximum length of 15 feet, 4.5 meters. So it is going to be shorter than your serial. All right, a modem uses a telephone wire to connect between computer and the phone line. The connector on the end of this wire is known as an RJ11 connector. This is important to know that it is an RJ11 connector because you will need to know the difference between that and its sister, RJ45 connector, which is used to connect to a LAN or Ethernet. Universal Serial Bus, USB, is a replacement for serial and parallel ports. USB peripherals are hot swappable, meaning you do not have to turn the computer off to connect or disconnect them. You do, however, have to turn it off for a parallel or serial connection. So that is why USB is so much better.
No, you do not have to turn off for a serial.
No?
No, absolutely not.
No,
serial is hot pluggable.
Parallel is a good idea. Oops, sorry.
I don't think you need to.
You do. You can for parallel, but the serial specification says that you can see up to 15 volts on any pin of the serial connector, and any device that contains circuitry will survive at least 15 volts on any pin of its connector.
I know that on the Braille and Speak, if you tried to screw around with the parallel connectors and the Braille and Speak connector without turning things off and on in the proper order, and of course I can't remember what it is because I haven't done it in a long time, or the serial, the parallel, you had to be very careful, because if you did it wrong, then you'd get garbage on your printer and you'd wonder why it wouldn't work, and then you're like, oh, I did it wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that. I'm sure the Baolite used to not mind.
I remember all that. A single USB port can support up to 127 devices by daisy-chaining hubs. That is important to know. You need to know that one USB port supports 127 devices. It also provides limited amounts of power to devices. We've got a few different standards of USB. The old standard, USB 1.1, allows transmission rates up to 12 Mbps in full speed mode and 1.5 megabits in low speed mode. USB 2.0 allows transmission speeds of up to 480 Mbps. USB 3 has now been released, but has not become popular just yet. We have two USB 3 ports on our new computers, but we don't have any devices that run them yet. USB devices can only transfer data up to the maximum speed allowed by the specific port. So if you plug in your high-speed or high-draw thumb drive to a USB 1.1 port, it may go slowly or not work at all.
And you will probably get, pop, this device can perform faster. And if your computer only has 1.1, it gets really annoying, because you're like, yes, I know, you tell me every time.
They are backward compatible, but they can be slow, and sometimes you may not get enough power to run certain devices on certain ports. If a USB 2.0 device is inserted into, yes, I said that it's going to go at 1.0 speeds. We've got FireWire, or IEEE, E1394. This is a proprietary standard developed by Apple. It is also hot swappable and can power devices. It supports up to 63 separate devices per single port. The IEEE 1394A standard supports data rates of up to 400 megabits per second and cable lengths up to 15 feet or 4.5 meters. This standard uses either a 4 or 6 pin connector, and that, my friends, is in your test. The IEEE 1394B standard allows for a greater range of connections, including Cat5, UTP, and optical fiber. But if you're going to go for a regular IEEE 1394B connector, you will want a 9 pin connector, and it is a speed of 800 megabits per second or greater. So if this IEEE 1394 is a proprietary standard, does anyone have any ideas of why it might not have caught on as well as USB?
I know. Oh, wait, I can't.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I actually have a FireWire on my MacBook on both my computers, I think, and I never use them at all, so...
Can anyone,
really popular,
does anyone
have... sorry, I was...
Go ahead,
They're
go.
Really popular in, like, the video editing community and stuff just because of the speeds.
No, it's not the speed, actually. It's the fact that they can do isochronous transfer, which is real-time transfer, so that your frames come up synchronized and stuff. It's not actually the speed. But that's cool.
Okay.
Yeah, unless you're talking about
that's
the FireWire... the 1394B, it does have a higher speed, but the actual attraction for FireWire as far as audio and video gear is that because of the real-time transfer, things remain synchronized between your audio and your video more than they do on USB.
The reason that FireWire hasn't taken off as much as it could have is that your USB was more of an open standard. If you wanted to make FireWire devices, you had to pay Apple royalties, this, that, and the other. And
I think it's 25 cents per port, I think I read somewhere.
Wow.
Maybe, that may be wrong, but I think I... So basically, one of the reasons, like Grace said, the manufacturers of PCs and whatever have to give Apple their money to get firewire, mm-hmm. So you're right.
So not as many firewire.
One good use of them before we move on. You can hook two Macs together, put one of them in target disk mode by holding down T after the bong, and then that computer will become a hard drive. And that's the way that works. So it can be useful for things like that. Okie dokie.
So depending on what kind of cable you use, FireWire B can go up to 3.2 gigabits over 100 meter distances. All right. A SCSI port can
it
transmit...
It is pretty uncommon... I use some pretty high-end, audio editing stuff, and unfortunately it is really rare to see any, $1,000 mixers or that kind of thing that are on USB. If it's external, it's pretty much always FireWire.
It's the whole Pro Tool runs the audio industry deal, and Pro Tools runs on a Mac.
Yeah, that's part of it, but...
Okay, a SCSI port can transmit...
Mac FireWire for some reason.
Yeah. A SCSI port can transmit parallel data at rates in excess of 320 megabits and can support up to 15 devices. If a single SCSI device is connected to a port, the cable can be up to 80 feet or 24.4 meters in length. If multiple SCSI devices are connected to a SCSI port, the cable can be up to 40 feet, 12.2 meters. SCSI devices must be terminated at the endpoint of the SCSI chain. Check the device manual for termination procedures. The device might be able to be put into terminate mode, so it can be a terminating device, or you'll actually need a terminator. Some SCSI...
May I ask?
Cable... Go ahead.
Why does it have to be terminated? I've used SCSI, and I often wondered why.
Because when you are sending the signal along the SCSI bus, so say for example you've got just as a sample configuration, you've got an internal SCSI CD-ROM, you've got a SCSI card, and you've got an external SCSI scanner hooked onto the same card, when the signal gets to the end of the cable, if there is no terminating resistor to dampen out the signal, the signal will reflect back along the cable and it will disrupt the signal by causing echoes, which is why you need to terminate the ends of the SCSI bus. You basically need all the extra stuff to be eaten by the resistors at the end of the cable so that it doesn't reflect back along the cable. It's the same reason we terminate 10 base T is terminated. It's the same reason we terminate 10 base 2 Ethernet with those little terminators that screw on the end of the cables.
So it sort of shorts out that electrical message or something?
It doesn't short it out, it uses it up. A resistor resists the flow of current to stop it from flowing back round and reflecting back again. So it doesn't short it, it just sort of eats it, if you like. The resistors absorb the extra power.
It terminates the power. It's not going anywhere, it's ending in that point. The voltage is done.
Thank you.
No problem. Okay, so SCSI devices look a lot like some of them, or the cables can look like parallel ports, but don't plug them into the parallel ports or vice versa. You may want to actually label your cables with Braille labeling tape or whatever you want to do so that you know the difference between your SCSI and your parallels. We spoke about RJ45 ports. They connect computers to networks. The speed at which data can be transferred is determined by the network card in the computer. Standard Ethernet can transmit up to 10 megabits. Fast Ethernet can transmit up to 100 megabits. And Gigabit Ethernet can transmit up to 1,000 megabits. The maximum length of network cables is 328 feet or 100 meters. That's in your test. So now, RJ11 is your modem cable, RJ45 is your Ethernet cable. Ethernet cables can go up to 328 feet or 100 meters, and we'll come back to the different standards and all of that of Ethernet cable in Module 8. PS2 connectors.
When I get really bored, I'm going to look up RJ connectors and see why there's so many.
Go ahead. What's your question, Luke?
Which one is the RJ11? Is it the little square one that goes into the modem, or is it the rectangle one that goes into the phone? Because one's an RJ9 and one's an RJ11, according to the...
No, RJ9's a typo. We fixed the typo. It's actually RJ11 and RJ12 are the two different connectors. According to these notes, RJ11 is the one that goes into the bottom of the phone, and RJ12 is the one that plugs from the handset to the phone.
Oh, okay.
I thought that was 10, but I'll have to look.
So what's that little rectangular one that goes into the
That's
wall?
Something completely and utterly different.
I wonder if that's
the
splitter.
The big flat one. Is it a little one, or is it the big flat one with the pins that poke out of it?
No, he's talking about the little flat one, the little flat rectangle.
That's an RJ12. It is.
Is it?
Sorry, RJ11, I should say.
No. Isn't the RJ11 is the actual one that goes into the phone?
No, we have this argument every year, and the notes tell us that the RJ11 is the one that goes from the bottom of the phone to the wall,
right.
And it's the same connector on the wall. It depends on who does your wall plates, because what you've got to understand about RJ11s and RJ45s is that there are actually jacks that are built in such a way that you can plug either an RJ11 or an RJ45 into the jack, and they'll take either. Because it'll actually just not use the outer two pins on the jack. So it just depends on who does your wall plates and what you're plugging into them.
For Americans...
And then different countries have their own phone lines, don't they?
British connectors.
Has their own...
In Australia and New Zealand, we have some very different connectors. For Americans, doing this is quite simple, because you only have that RJ11 connector. That's all you have to worry about. Between the handset and the phone is something else. But for people in Australia, you'll have these little rectangular connectors that are flat and rectangular and quite different to the ones that we have.
Oh, okay. So that's something different again, because...
Yeah, I believe
so. Yeah,
that's
what was confusing me, because you've got the square one, which you're telling me is the RJ11, which plugs into the phone, but then the other end of that cable is this little...
It is something else. That is a completely different connector.
Actually, if somebody wants to Wikipedia up the RJ11...
Go ahead.
Oh, you only have RJ11, do you, Dina, over there?
Yeah, for your phone system, it's just RJ11.
Yep, that's how the American systems work as well.
Yeah, if somebody wants to Wikipedia up and demystify the RJ11 and 12, that'd be good. Otherwise, I'll go and do it after lecture and find out exactly what the... Because this has been a point of argument for about the last 15 years I've been doing computers, and I've never seen an answer that's clarified it. So we'll just say it's RJ11 because that's what their notes say.
Remember that Cisco is in America, and so they're thinking about American internet setups and phone setups.
The actual big flat cables that Luke's talking about are actually more rugged, and you will never break the little retaining lug off one of those big flat ones, because it doesn't have one. It just sort of pushes into the wall and sort of locks into place with this odd-shaped plastic thing in the middle of it. They're an odd connector.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact nomenclature.
They do have a clip on them, Gary.
Oh, no, you're not talking about the same connector I am. I'm talking about one that is about an inch and a half across, quarter inch high, has four pins sticking out of it. You're not talking about the connector I'm talking about then. Yeah, no worries. Let's just pretend that big funny connector doesn't exist for our...
Yeah. All right. We've got PS2 connectors, which are 6-pin mini-DIN connectors. They are round and connect keyboards and mice. They're usually color-coded, and many have little figures of a keyboard or mouse, which you can feel with your fingers, or if you can't feel them with your fingers and it's your computer, you can feel that figure with your tongue. Not occupational health and safety approved, but you can do it if it's yours. All right. Does anyone have any questions on
always
audio device?
Always turn your computer off before you unplug and plug these cables.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
These little cables, because motherboards can be fried, and it's just not a good idea. And I really had to get on my coworkers about this, because they didn't No, that you're not supposed to do it. But I said, unless we want fried motherboards, we gotta turn these off before we eject these. Oh, I have a funny keyboard story for you later, Grace.
Okay.
PS2 connectors are not hot pluggable. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Definitely.
I actually had a computer, and I didn't intend to, but I put the mouse and the keyboard in the wrong spot, and it yelled at me for it.
Yeah. Sometimes they will. And sometimes they'll just not start, and you'll wonder what happened. So if you've just plugged a keyboard or mouse in, and your computer won't start, you may want to swap the port that it is in. Because
the other thing,
got one more question, Carrie, and you.
Sorry, I was just going to say, if you're a blind person that's one of those people that tries to plug in DINs by rotating them and stuffing them in the socket until they fit,
and
you've broken a couple of braille sensors, braille lights, or braille bricks by winding them around and jamming them in until you think they'll actually push in, it's worth knowing what the orientation of the little markers, if there is a marker on them, and there weren't on some of them, of those cables should be. If you have a desktop case on a computer, normally the markers face upwards because the circuit board is lying down flat, the motherboard is lying flat in the case. If you have a tower, the marker needs to point to the right if you're reaching back behind the case, so it's pointing to the right-hand side of the case. So have some idea as to what orientation you think it should go in before you start putting it in, and do not force it into the socket and spin it until it fits, or you will break off half the pins and do horrible things to either the sockets or the connectors. Remove the connector from the socket before rotating it and try reinserting it.
There's also a little kind of half U thing on the cable. If your cable doesn't have markers, learn which way to orient that. It won't be opposite of whatever the marker is usually, but learn the orientation either if there is a marker on the outside of the connector or the like half circle or U-shaped thing on the actual plug. Or if you're not sure the first time, get somebody sighted, and then once they put it in right, take it out and look how they did it.
We actually banned somebody, a mutual friend of ours, from inserting and removing her PS2 connectors. We're like, now once that's plugged in, you leave it plugged in.
Oh, yeah.
Because her dad was there with a screwdriver straightening out pins and praying to every deity on the planet.
One quick keyboard question, Carrie, because I know you explained this before and I want the Reader's Digest version, because I just got asked last week, why does it say press F1 to continue if there's no keyboard again?
You can actually, on certain machines, plug in a keyboard and press F1, and I believe F1 is scan code 1. It's actually the, or scan code 1 or 2, it's one of the really low-numbered scan codes, so they actually pick that up because it's apparently the easiest one for them to detect, and there are actually some computers where you can actually hot-plug the PS2s and then press F1, and it will actually work. However, it's not
recommended. Because we wondered, because it says, no keyboard present, press F1, and everybody always says, well,
you could always plug in a USB one and press F1.
Yeah,
no. There were actually cases where if the keyboard controller didn't initialize properly, I believe pressing F1 was also enough to actually unlatch it, and then the BIOS could actually find it, and it would actually continue. I have actually seen that happen.
Fair enough. All right. Everybody understands about audio devices, that you can plug in speakers and microphones and all of that to your sound cards, right? We're blind, we understand that. Is that good? Any questions
on
that?
Do we all know what the colors are?
They don't even have that in here.
Green is usually the speakers, pink is usually the microphone, and gray is usually the
line in,
I think.
Yes, and that was specified by the PC99 standard, and people do adhere to that. And you will be asked, which one am I plugging in, the pink one or the green one? We're not going to test you on it, but
if there's three jacks, there's usually
the
green one tends to be in the middle. If there's only three, I've noticed that the speaker plug tends to be the middle of the three. Okay.
Yeah, normally it is
the ones
short.
I've
normally
seen it on top, especially on the integrated one.
Yeah, it's usually except for the time you really want it to be, and then it isn't.
Yeah.
All right. Video ports quickly connect monitors to a computer. There are several video ports and connector types. We've got video graphics array (VGA). This has three rows of 15 pins. It's female connector and provides analog output to a monitor.
Wait a minute.
Clarification,
three rows of pins, and there's 15 total.
Of 15 pins, yes.
I almost was like, wait a minute, whoa.
Yeah, so it's a
15-pin
connector, and
yeah,
it has
three rows of pins. So three rows
and
five
pins. And they're very easily bent because the connectors are so heavy, so be very careful with them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, they
DVI. DVI has a 24-pin female connector or a 29-pin female connector and provides an uncompressed digital output to a monitor. DVI-I provides both analog and digital signals. We've got DVI-D providing digital signals only. High definition multimedia interface, HDMI. HDMI has 19 pin connectors and provides digital video and digital audio signals.
Be careful with the DVI-I and the DVI-D because some Apple, Mac stuff, thank you Apple, will only provide one sort of signal, as in DVI-D, and if you have a monitor with DVI-I, which is the analog type of connector, it will not work on your Apple. So either speak to the people at the Apple store and empty your wallet, or know what you're connecting up.
And we've got S-Video.
They do have DVI to VGAs, if you need them. I have one.
I've got one. Most computers come with those.
That doesn't work with the digital stuff, though, as we discovered the hard way. It's not sufficient to convert the DVI to VGA if your Mac puts out a digital output. Thank you, Xserve.
Mine must be really old and put out analog, then.
Yeah, the newer Minis also only put out digital. Like, the newer generation of Minis, I think, put out the digital.
Yeah, I think they've only got HDMI. I think the new ones have only HDMI.
Okay. S-Video is a 4-pin connector and provides analog video signals. And this thing looks like a mouse connector. In fact, if you feel it, it feels like a PS2 connector. In fact, the person who did our diagram descriptions got completely confused and called it a mouse connector, and we just found out last week. So, be careful.
Thank you to the student who has been emailing
us.
And then if anyone finds more errors with the diagram descriptions or things they're not sure if they are, please let us know via email and we will get Sighted Health to check. And we appreciate it very much.
Yes. This has
very much been a work in progress for a long time.
I think we're getting there, though. Alright. Component RGB has three shielded cables, red, green, and blue, with RCA jacks, and provides analog video signals. They're as old as the hills. All right.
Has anyone seen the ones with the five BNCs where you've got red, green, blue, H-Sync, and V-Sync?
I think the HDTV we have has that.
No, I don't think
Something
so.
Weird.
And let's not talk about SCART, shall we? Moving right along.
All right. Input devices are used to enter data into computers. All right, guys, wake up. Time to name some input devices.
Keyboard.
Yep, absolutely. Microphone. Mouse, microphone, yep, absolutely. Cameras, scanners, biometric devices. We're in the middle of lecture. We'll be done at 11.
Touchpads.
Graphics.
We'll be available at 11.
Joysticks.
All right. The two most common input devices are keyboards and mice, and this is very important because they're going to ask you this on your test. We've got something called a KVM switch. This allows you to share keyboards, mice, and video between computers. This is great for server environments or home users who only have one of each and limited space. Your new KVMs
get one of these.
Allow you to share. Yeah, they're cool. Allow you to share USB devices and even speakers. A touch screen has a pressure or heat sensitive transparent panel. The computer or device receives instructions specific to the place on the screen that the user touches. So your iPod, iPhone, and even your kiosk at the grocery store have that. We also have biometric devices, which are fingerprint scanners and such things, retina scanners, and voice recognition software. Now, the text has decided that these are the most secure devices to be used for access to computers, because they have now cleaned them up in a serious way, and now they, I guess, are, unless somebody goes and cuts your finger off, then they're going to get access to your computer. Okay, let's name some output devices, guys.
Screen.
Monitor.
Monitor, yes, absolutely.
Speakers.
Speakers! Absolutely. You've got the speakers, and the monitor is your most common output device. The most important...
Printers, too.
Printers, of course. But the monitor is the most common. There are three common types of monitors. The most important differences between these monitor types is the technology used to create an image. We've got CRT. These are the big ones, the cathode ray tubes, CRTs. It has three electron beams. Each beam directs colored phosphor on the screen that flows either red, green, or blue. Areas not struck by an electron beam do not glow. So you've got these glowing phosphorus beams that are struck by electrons, and that's how you get your image. The combination of glowing and non-glowing areas creates an image on the screen. This technology is also used by most televisions. Well, not anymore. CRTs usually have a degauss button on the front that users can press to remove discoloration caused by magnetic interference. Now, the modern ones that most people are going to be using are LCDs or liquid crystal displays. These are commonly used in flat panel monitors, laptops, and some projectors. This consists of two polarized filters with a liquid crystal solution between them. An electronic current aligns the crystals so that light can either pass through or not pass through. The effect of light passing through in certain areas and not in others is what creates the image. So we've got two forms of LCDs. We've got active matrix and passive matrix. Active matrix is sometimes called thin film transistor, or TFT. TFT allows each pixel to be controlled, which creates very sharp color images. Passive matrix is less expensive than active matrix, but does not provide the same level of image control. Passive matrix is not commonly used in laptops. And we've got DLP, digital light processing. This is the last technology that is commonly used in screens. This is for projectors. DLP projectors use a spinning color wheel with a microprocessor-controlled array of mirrors called a digital micro-mirror device, DMD. Each mirror corresponds to a specific pixel. Each mirror reflects light towards or away from the projector optics, and this creates your monochromatic image of up to 1024 shades of gray in between white and black. The color wheel then adds the color data to complete the projected color image. This stuff is not on your test, but it's interesting to know. Okay,
there was an ad for DLP that said it's all about the mirrors, I think it said, or it was
and it is
that someone had put out. It was kind of cute.
Okay, this is on your test though. Monitor resolutions refer to the level of image detail that can be reproduced. The higher the resolution is set, the better the quality of the image on the screen. The monitor resolution is influenced by several factors, which we were going to talk about now. All right. The pixel, this is the basic building block of the image. The term pixel is an abbreviation for picture element. Pixels are the tiny dots that comprise a screen. Each pixel consists of red, green, and blue. So those are the building blocks of your image. Dot pitch. This is the distance between the pixels on a screen. So imagine a piece of braille paper covered in braille dots. It is how far apart those braille dots are would be from each other. A lower dot pitch number produces a better image. So the closer those dots are together, the better the image is going to be. We've got the contrast ratio. The contrast ratio is the measurement of different intensities of light between the brightest point, white, and the darkest point, black. A 10,000 to 1 contrast ratio shows dimmer white and lighter black than a monitor with a contrast ratio of 1 million to 1. Okay, the refresh rate is how often per second the image is rebuilt. A higher refresh rate produces a better image and reduces the length, the amount of flicker. So you want the highest refresh rate possible. In fact, if you have a refresh rate lower than 60 Hz, it can make people feel sick or dizzy or seasick, and if you have somebody who is epileptic, that can be very bad.
Can I ask a question there, Grace?
Go ahead.
My flat monitor says that it needs a hertz of 72, but that's not available on my card. What do you set?
Probably something higher?
No? Do not set higher. You let the card auto-detect it. If the monitor wants 72, you let the card go as close to 72 as you can without actually reaching 72. If you actually set a refresh rate higher than what the monitor can support, you, in your best case scenario, you'll get a message.
That's going to blow you.
Blank screen, and then if you have worst case scenario, it will actually blow up the monitor. So normally you let the monitor auto-detect
what it needs.
So you
want to go lower?
Yeah, you should be able to get away with 60 hertz or something. Often cards do have 72. That is a Visa resolution. You've got to understand, though, that depending on what resolution you're at, the rest of the refresh range changes based on what resolution you're at. So you can usually do 640 by 480 at 72 hertz, and the higher the resolution, the lower the refresh rate generally, because you're actually refreshing more pixels. Generally, Windows does a good job at guessing the best resolution. Often upgrading your video card drivers to the latest will unlock some of the resolution, the refresh rates.
Be careful when adjusting resolution on your Mac, because the resolution and refresh rates are grouped together. Be very careful.
I knew that about
the
refresh rate.
So they'll have 800 by 600 at 60, and they'll have 800 by 600 at 75, and whatever. So be careful and make sure you use the mouse cursor, turn off cursor tracking, and click the one you actually want.
Okay, we've got interlaced monitors that create the image by scanning the screen two times. The first scans covers the odd lines, top to bottom, and the second scan covers the even lines. Non-interlaced monitors create the image by scanning the screen one line at a time from top to bottom. Most CRT monitors today are non-interlaced. All right, we've got horizontal vertical color, HVC. The number of pixels in a line is the horizontal resolution. The number of lines on a screen is the vertical resolution. The number of colors that can be reproduced is the color resolution. We've got the aspect ratio. The aspect ratio is the horizontal vertical measurement of the viewing area of a monitor. For example, a 4-3 aspect ratio would apply to a viewing area that is 16 inches wide by 12 inches high. A 4-3 aspect ratio would also apply to a viewing area that is 24 inches wide by 18 inches high. A viewing area that is 22 inches wide by 12 inches high has an aspect ratio of 11 to 6.
Interesting point. If you are using screen magnification, widescreen monitors are not very good for you because you will actually be doing a lot of vertical scrolling because you don't have enough vertical pixels to actually represent the fonts nicely, so you end up going on that mouse wheel to actually pull things up and down. You got plenty of width on your screen, but not a lot of vertical height. And that is worth considering. So you've got to make sure you get a really big widescreen if you are going to do the low vision thing and magnify your text. Otherwise, you will do excessive scrolling.
Native resolution is the number of pixels that a monitor has. A monitor with a resolution of 1280 by 1024 has 1280 horizontal pictures and 1024 vertical pixels. Native mode is when the image sent to the monitor matches the native resolution of the monitor, and this is the best way you can set your monitors.
This is really important, guys. If you are low vision, do not drop your screen resolution to 800 by 600 because it makes stuff look bigger. Actually set your screen to the native resolution and magnify because it will look far better on your LCD monitor.
All right. And you have a bit of information here about different controls that can be on your monitor. There you go. You have a bunch of controls that can be on your monitor that you guys can look at in your notes. All right. The last thing I want to talk to you guys about today is system resources. These are used for communication between the CPU and other components. There are three common system resources. The first one we're going to talk about is interrupt requests, or IRQs. These are used by computer components to request information from the CPU. The IRQ travels along a wire on a motherboard to the CPU. When the CPU receives an interrupt request, the CPU determines how to fulfill this request. The priority of the request is determined by the IRQ number assigned to that component. Older computers only had 8 IRQs to assign to devices. Newer computers have 16 IRQs, which are numbered 0 to 15. As a general rule, each component must be assigned a unique IRQ. If two devices are assigned the same IRQ, this can cause a conflict and the components may stop working or the whole computer can freeze up and crash.
Does it talk about IRQ sharing there?
Yeah, it does. Today, most IRQ numbers are assigned automatically with plug and play, and the operating system implementation of PCI slots, USB ports, and FireWire ports. With the components that is installed, it is difficult to assign unique IRQs to every component, so PCI devices can now share IRQs without conflict. This isn't something you're really going to have to worry about too much until you do. Usually, you won't have IRQ conflicts or anything like that because your operating system takes care of it until sometime it doesn't, and then this is when you have to think about your IRQs. There's a table that shows what devices are generally assigned to IRQ numbers. If you're taking A+, I'd memorize that table. There are 16 of them. Input-output I.O. Port addresses. These addresses are used to communicate between devices and software. The I.O. port addresses used to send and receive data for a component. As with IRQs, each component will have a unique I.O. port assigned. There are 6,535 I.O. ports in a computer.
There are 65,535.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
In a computer, and they are represented by hexadecimal addresses in the range 0000H to FFFFH. Figure 2 shows a chart of the commonly assigned I.O. ports. You don't have to memorize those in any way at all. You just have to know what they do. which I've told you.
Has anybody ever noticed that if you go into Windows Device Manager and double-click on the top of the tree where it says My Computer Opened or whatever your name is, it will actually show you a list of all the allocated resources in a nifty little table?
I didn't know that.
I don't think I've got mine to do it.
I've got mine to do it. And if you do Lab 5.4.8, you'll be using that table.
You need to double-click with the JAWS cursor. You cannot just hit enter on it or whatever. You actually have to JAWS
cursor
to it.
Yeah, I think I tried that.
The last
I'll
one...
I'll play with it again when I get bored.
Fair enough. The last one we're going to talk about is DMA access. These channels are used by high-speed devices to communicate directly with main memory. These channels allow devices to bypass interaction with the CPU and directly store and retrieve information from memory. Only certain devices can be assigned DMA channels, such as SCSI host adapters and sound cards. Older computers only had 4 DMA channels to assign to components. Newer computers have 8 DMA channels that are numbered 0 to 7. All right, that's the end of the module. Any questions from anybody before we go on to our quiz? Okay, guys, it's time to wake up and do this quiz.
Does the quiz go on to the beginning of Chapter 2's recording, or are we going to just stick it here?
Not usually. What do you think, Carrie?
I thought we used to stick it on the beginning of the next one.
Yeah, we'll just... We're running them two together. Let's stick it on the end of this one.
All right, fair enough. Just thought I'd ask.
All right, everybody, get into chat. Does everybody know how to get into chat? Yep. There you go.
If you don't know, that's okay. Don't be embarrassed. We'll help you.
Can someone remind me? Sorry.
You're on a Mac.
There's a button that says chat.
Okay.
Just do a VO right arrow a couple times from the column 1 table where the people are. Or you can use the item chooser. We'll help you get there too.
Tom, wake up! If you're...
Who, me?
Yes, you.
Yes.
Time to get into chat. There she is.
It is time.
It's time to see what we have learned. All right.
Wow. Cool.
What?
I don't know what happened, but you said time for Tom to get into chat, and then you went, "Oh, there she is," and I'm like, "Wait a minute."
Oh no, I was looking at
really
Ellie.
Fun.
I was doing two different things. No, we weren't there. All right. So, question
that's only
one.
On weekends.
Oh, okay. Okay, darling.
Oh, dear.
All right. So, what's going to happen here is I'm going to ask you guys questions, and I'm going to give you multiple choice answers. For the ones that have only one answer, it's going to be A, B, C, D, or E, and you just type in your answer when I say answer now. Wait to press enter until I say answer now, or you will give everybody else the answer. If it is a yes or no question, or if there are multiple answers, we will go yes or no, and you just type Y or N into chat. All right, so with that, we'll begin. What is the maximum data speed of high-speed USB 2.0? Is it A, 1.5 megabits, B, 12 megabits, C, 380 megabits, or D, 480 megabits? Choose now. Yep. And the people who said D, you are absolutely right. Good job. It is
I'll be
D.
Back in a sec. Someone's just washing our windows.
Okay. That is 480
megabits. I just want to make sure
megabits.
They're all shut.
All right.
When are we supposed to hit enter on this?
When I say choose now or answer now.
Yeah, so you can get your answer when you think
ready.
You're ready.
Just don't press enter until I say choose now or answer now. Okay. Which IEEE standard defines the FireWire technology? Is it A, 1284, B, 1394, C, 1451, or D, 1539? Answer now. And the answer is B, 1394. Good job, guys. All right. What is the maximum data rate supported by the IEEE IEEE 1394 standard? Is it A, 200 megabits?
You can also read it as IEEE if you like.
I can, and I just haven't, and I should.
That's what I'm going to do.
380 megabits. C, 400 megabits. Or D, 800 megabits. Choose now.
Sorry,
The answer is actually C, because we're talking about the A standard, not the B standard. We did cover that today. So
you did, but you didn't. You said 1394, not which one.
Oh, I didn't.
Yeah, I is 400.
No,
A
it
is
actually
800.
Doesn't say. This question just asked about 1394 in general. I would assume if they're not specifying
no, it did
B,
say
that
A.
They mean
no,
A.
I did, oh, it did say A. It did, and I must not have said. Okay, so either one would have been right. Sorry about that. All right. What is the purpose of a heatsink installed on a processor? Is it A, to set the processor voltage? B, to cool the processor? C, to set the processor speed? Or D, to ground the processor? Choose now. Awesome. B is absolutely right. Good job, guys. Right, number 5. A technician receives a complaint of poor image quality after the user changes the native resolution. While investigating the complaint, the technician discovers there is a mismatch between native mode and the native resolution of the peripheral. Which item is configured incorrectly? Is it A, DLP, B, LCD, C, printer, or D, the scanner? Choose now. It is B. It's going to be your LCD monitor that has an incorrect native resolution. All right. Which CPU is manufactured as a multi-core processor with one of the cores disabled? Is it A, dual core, B, triple core, C, quad core, or D, RISC core? Choose now. It's going to be B. A triple-core processor is a quad-core processor with one of the cores disabled. 7. Which RAM module has the highest peak transfer rate? Is it A, PC100 SDRAM, B, PC133 SDRAM, C, DDR333, D, DDR3, 1600. Choose now. D is absolutely right. Because it is DDR3, that is going to have the fastest transfer rate. Which memory module has a front-side bus speed of 200 megahertz? And this is actually quite tricky. And if we don't get it, I'll explain how we do get the answer to this. Is it A, 333, B, DDR400, C, DDR3667, or D, PC100 SDRAM? Choose now. For those of you who said B, you're right, because this is double data rate RAM. So if we divide 400 by 2, we're going to get 200. And so that will be its front side bus speed. 9. Which three adapter cards customize and expand the capabilities of a computer? Choose 3. So this will be a yes or no question. All right. The first one is EEPROM. Yes or no? And everybody who said N or no, that's everybody, is right. How about B, a TV tuner card? You all are absolutely right. That is a yes. C, wireless NIC. Absolutely right. D, DDR-SDRAM. And you're absolutely right. That would be no. E, USB. No, because that is not a peripheral adapter card. That's just a port. You could have a USB adapter card, but I think it just meant USB port. So I don't know. That's a really tricky, weird one. Or D.
Yeah,
or, sorry,
we come across that last semester as well?
We did. We did. And the last one is a capture card. Absolutely. All right, 10. Which two signal sources could be connected to a TV tuner adapter card? Choose two, so this will be another yes or no. A, cable TV. Obviously, yes. Good job. B, SATA cable. Absolutely. C, TV antenna. Absolutely.
The answer
is right,
guys. No.
No, sorry, yep. And you know what? We've gone through all three, so honestly, we've gotten our two, so we can move on to the next one. All right. 11. What are two advantages of SSDs over magnetic hard drives? You'll be asked this in your real test, too, somewhat, I believe. A, higher storage capacity. Yes or no? That's absolutely right. No. Faster USB connectivity. No, that is absolutely right. No is correct. Ability of many SSDs to be seen as one logical drive. That's absolutely no. That's not. That would be RAID, and you could do that with any hard drive. Doesn't matter if it's SSD or magnetic.
That would not be a RAID. That would not be inexpensive disks.
No, that would be unbelievably expensive
SSDs.
RAID system. All right, reduce power usage. Absolutely, good job, guys. That's right. Yes. Oh, okay. What did? And faster access to data. Absolutely, that is right, guys. All right. Which two of
Which
the following
right?
opti- Yeah, that is right. Yes is right. It is faster data access.
All right.
Which two of the following optical media types can store more than 5 gigabytes and can be written? Is that A, BDR?
This is yes, no, guys.
Yes or no, sir.
See, when she says which two, it turns into a yes, no.
Yes. So no, because apparently they cannot be rewritten. How about BDR re?
No.
Yes.
BDR e, right?
Re. BDR re. Yes, that is correct. A BDR-RE can be rewritten and can carry more than 5 gigs. CDRW? No. No, that is right. How about a DVD-R? No, that would only be written once. And a DVR-W, and we'll just say it's dual layer for the purposes of this quiz. Absolutely, that is right. All right, 13. Which statement is true in a comparison of RAID 5 with RAID 1? A, RAID 5 takes more time to write data. B, RAID 5 uses one hard drive as a parity drive for data protection. For the same storage capacity, RAID 5 requires more hard drives than RAID 1. Or D, RAID 5 does not provide any protection for the data that is located on the hard drive. Choose now.
This is a nasty question.
It's a horrible question. For the people who... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say B, but it isn't necessarily one drive for parity. It could be more.
No, it's more.
The answer is A.
The answer is A.
and I was?
It takes more time to write data. RAID 5 takes more time to write data.
Is that right? Because it's writing in parallel. I would think C would be the right answer.
So I would agree with you, but that's what the test says. And we actually had it checked. So apparently, yeah, that's what they say. But I disagree with you as well.
No, you agree with him and disagree with him.
I agree with you. I disagree with them. Yes, that's what I mean.
Disagree with the test.
Which type of drive is used for external data storage and attaches using a 7-pin connector and has a maximum cable length of 2 meters, 6.56 feet? Is it A, PODA, B, SATA, C, eSATA, or D, SCSI? C is absolutely right. That is eSATA, external SATA. It's attaching
seven,
by a USB.
Seven, not by USB,
it's external.
SATA,
seven
data
pin
seven.
Connector, but it attaches externally. E for external. A network administrator currently has 3 servers and needs to add a 4th, but does not have enough room for an additional monitor and keyboard. Which device allows the administrator to connect all of the servers to a single monitor and keyboard? A. Touchscreen monitor, B. PS2 hub, C. USB switch, or D. KVM. And D is right. KVM switch will do the trick. All right, that's your quiz.
That went a little bit longer than we thought it did, huh? It would, huh?
It totally did.
Any questions, or should I stop this recording and do another one?
I think we'll stop and start.
Yeah. All right, let's see.
Any questions about any of that, guys? No, you don't need it.
The only thing I can say that might...
latency.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is actually. All we can say is that the future modules go a bit faster than module 1, which is always a complete drag.
They certainly do.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, there's an incredible amount of information, but if you all went through at this speed, then none of you would catch anything. So we don't.
Well, some of you would, but some of you
wouldn't.
Some
people might if they're good at understanding JAWS quickly.
Yeah, I would absolutely love my lectures to go at that speed. That is the speed I am most comfortable listening to information. But
interesting story from last semester. One time we actually did that, and we got Kerry to go through something. I can't even remember what it was, but we had about 5 minutes, and Kerry just blah blah blah. And when I was re-listening to the lecture, I actually played it on slow speed in Media Player. That's the only way to understand it.
I bet he sounded funny that way too.
That was awesome. All right, so Sean's got a lecture for you. Guys, you've just finished Module 1, and your task is to take the quiz. Now, if you do badly, that's okay. The exam. You call me up, and I will sit with you and go over your answers and help you figure out what you need to study. The good news is that all of your classmates that have taken it have passed. And actually done exceedingly well, and there was even somebody, I won't mention your name unless you want me to, who got 100%.
All right.
Damn. So,
yes, so you...
No pressure.
You rock. Congratulations, you're the second person ever to do that.
Didn't Mr. Jarvis do that this morning as well?
He did. He did do 100 on the module 1, so that's the third person.
I'm
out of class. You did.
If we took it last time, do you have to redo the exams?
No, you don't. Just the labs. No.
Are you finishing off in the last class, or are you finishing off in this class?
No, I've moved him over. He's actually moved.
And the exams came through?
Yep, they came with him.
Yeah, if you don't have a grade for an exam because you didn't take it last time, then you need to take it again. So if you did the first 8 exams and then didn't do the rest of them, you need to do the rest of them. We need a grade for each exam in your grade book. That's what it boils down to.
Can I look at my own?
Yeah, absolutely. Click on grade book. And it'll all be right there. Okay. If you need help, tell me, and I'll help you out. But I believe yours came with you.